So hi, my name's Jacob Serber. I'm a product manager at Adobe, and I've been spending a lot of my time lately thinking about HTML and how it relates to design. I think we've, obviously at Adobe, we've been doing design tools for a long time, Photoshop, Illustrator, Fireworks, but all of these are things that have been used to create print and create pages, and I've made a bold statement today that the page is dying. But I think to kind of understand that a little bit more, let's talk about the history of the page. There's been a long evolution. It's been one of the first things we did as a species. So let's go back to early Mesopotamia. We're talking 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And even then, we had tablets. They didn't change size. They were fixed, and people would stamp things out. It was pretty laborious. Language was all over the place. No design standards. Then we finally moved up to the cylinder seal, and this kind of worked out nicely because you could reuse. It was almost like printing, but again, you were locked into real estate. And I think once you got beyond printing something maybe a foot long, it really got kind of hard to move that large piece of stone around. So we went for quite a while till we got to about 600 AD in China. And they finally came up with movable type. It's impressive to think it took that long for somebody to say, you know what, let's just make one little thing and I can move it around. So they started out doing this with wood. Then they moved to clay and porcelain, but still it was a very laborious process, and using these materials, they weren't very reliable. And even that, in creating all of those individual little pieces, there was huge inconsistencies. But at this time, print was created as a way to control things. Once it was put down on paper, this was law, and the ability to put things in print was strictly controlled by the government. If you were caught with a printing press, if you want to call it that, back then it was punishable by death. So it was really used as a means of control, and this really persisted for a while till we get to this guy, Johannes Gutenberg. He finally created the mechanical printing press. And this really drastically changed everything. So we were in 1439, and this not only enabled people to create more types of print, but it also reduced the time and the cost that it took to print something. And they're saying it reduced it by about 80%. I mean, that's pretty substantial. That's a huge leap. And I think what's interesting is you'll see that all of these patterns that took place over the history of print keep repeating themselves. Protests. Anytime you have a dramatic shift like that, people are going to complain. So in May of 1472, scribes started complaining and tried to stop printing presses because it was strangers who were creating print. Up until that time, it was monks locked in a castle and singing and writing, and there was emotion behind it. You have those very ornate block lettering to begin a page. It's those kinds of things that embodied the soul of the print, but that was devoid in printing presses. But then you look at how this can be applied to today. Now you have people who are writing, but you're going digital. So the distribution method has changed again. People get cranky and look like Star Trek people. He is not helping the cause, just for the record. And again, reoccurring philosophies. Back in 1755, somebody first came up with the idea of information overload. You know, this is a really hot topic today because of how much information we're bombarded with constantly. But think about it, if you had relatively few books out there, and now books start to appear everywhere, how can you as a person start to consume this much knowledge? And he has a pretty good quote saying, you know, finding information in all of these books is akin to finding answers inside of nature. I mean, that's a bold statement. Thank God we have Google. So here's another popular document. And this also went to putting things in press gave it legitimacy. So as soon as the original Declaration of Independence was signed, they immediately rushed it to a printer and created 200 copies and then sent those with people to every reaches of the Union. And again, to legitimize what just happened. But we also started to see the change in people were looking at print and at publications now as freedom rather than oppression. So Thomas Jefferson came, and I think there was a couple of interesting pieces here, where up until this point it was very much about controlling the books and keeping them locked down. But by using the printing press and creating many, many copies, you can get information out there and you can also preserve it. You know, even if there's a fire, you're not going to lose all of your copies if you make many. So this brings us to our first steam-powered printing press. And this really enabled newspapers specifically to start churning out copies. This was the London Times was the first person to use this. And soon after it was implemented, it's cranking out over 1,000 pages an hour. And again, this starts to revolutionize the way information can be spread. You know, when I had to manually set all of my type, it was going to take hours, even after it's written, to then print it, to distribute it. Now that time is starting to drastically compress. So in talking about printing, and I mean, let's be honest, we're probably a bunch of designers here. Times New Roman, I think we're all familiar with this guy. It's been around since 1932. As I was doing a lot of the research for this talk, I thought it was interesting, you know, just the pieces of type that we use every day and take for granted and sometimes scoff at. You know, they've been a part of culture now for a very long time. You move on and courier. I spent a long time as a developer, so courier is kind of near to my heart. If we didn't talk about Helvetica, somebody in here would probably yell at me. So all of these things have been around for so long that you know, we honestly don't know what design life would be like without these pillars. So things stayed relatively stable until Steve. You know, he introduced the Mac. And the Mac brought with it a whole new set of options. I mean, you know, the core philosophies to his design behind the Mac was providing experience, providing color, providing interactivity, and giving power to individuals in their homes to create these publications. I mean, that level of power, I mean, had never existed before. You know, I wasn't going to haul that probably 2-ton steam-powered printing press into my basement. But now I could do it with a Mac. And so that brought us things like PageMaker. So all this brought us PageMaker, and now it was interesting, and again, I think it's cyclical how new things replicate old and old replicate new. But they went into the software to try and change how or replicate the metaphor of laying things out. You know, a lot of it makes sense, but the goal was replication and not necessarily thinking how could this be done better or different. And I guess I would be remiss without saying, Adobe, we did some stuff around this. Our founders, John and Chuck, back in 1982, created PostScript. And so prior to this, it really was akin to typesetting, where you had individual bitmaps of fonts. You know, they scaled terribly. They weren't scalable. But when you went to PostScript, now everything was vector. There was round edges. You could have headlines. You could have body copy. And you could start to see how now all of the fonts that existed in the font foundries can be converted over to PostScript. Now that I have a bunch of type, we introduced the PDF. So what the PDF did was take all of these pages and alleviate it being seen and consumed in different ways. When you created something and you packaged it in a PDF and you gave it to somebody, almost regardless of where or how they were going to consume that PDF, you as the designer of that page had complete control over that experience. And that was great. Then we bring in HTML. It is amazing to think that HTML4 was first recommended in 1997. It was quite a while ago. But what HTML did is it gave individuals, designers, developers, easy and different ways of creating their layout and ultimately through markup, but to control how that page is created. Because they were hearing about this thing called the internet. Somebody said it could be good. Turns out it was. So everybody uses the internet. Anybody here not using it? So once we started using the internet on our desktops got bigger and faster. Then we started to get new devices, and they were smaller and still pretty fast. And turns out we really like those too. So here you can see the general trend where desktops are certainly increasing. But the level of growth that you're getting on mobile devices and tablet devices is at such a higher rate than the desktop adoption. I mean, it literally is not fathomable. I mean, you haven't seen an adoption of a technology or a method of consuming information that fast ever. I mean, throughout time, nothing like this has ever happened. And I think as designers, we have to keep that in mind, where we cannot focus on creating something static or that you think it's going to be consumed here. If you saw any of the presentations this morning, there was looking at the old design specs of where we would target 1024 by 768, fallback to 800 by 600, things like that. Like, that just doesn't even come close to existing anymore. And so here you can actually see how crazy high that line is compared to everything else. I mean, the data and the amount of information that people are getting through these channels, I mean, is just staggering. So now as a person that's creating information, disseminating this information, you have a lot of options to put that information on. You've got a desktop screen, 2560 by 1650, I think. 1440 by 600, 1024 by 768, or the new one now has just got some sort of an insane resolution. But now with the mobile devices, you have portrait, you have landscape, you have variation. You can double tap and zoom in. Like the amount of screens that you have to account for is crippling. And so the philosophy behind responsive design is don't let that cripple you. Think about the things that you need to convey to your audience, how and where, and move from there. So what are your options in dealing with all of these different screens? One of the common things that's happened is you create a m.yourwebsite.com. So maybe you took your website and you fed it to a service and they fed you back something, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say it was probably terrible. It was abstracted away from the intent of your original website. It didn't have the information that was relevant to that screen size, that device, where the person was going to be consuming the information. And even that is pretty generic. So I guess if you're going to cling to that as an option, we need to start going a little bit further. Now I probably need an iPad.website. Then I'm going to have to deal with landscape of my iPad. And then, now that we got the 4S, I'm going to need a 4S specific version. Like, this is terrible. And not only that, it's going to take a tremendous amount of work to keep all of that together, to keep it updated, in sync, and relevant. And at the end of the day, I'm a lazy panda. I don't like that. I got one awe. I try to work in at least one panda picture per presentation. It's a nice little break. Have a sip. We can take that in. All right, option two. There's got to be something better, right? One ring to rule them all, or one sight to rule them all. I think the ring is way more impactful. But if we take the approach of responsive, if we use the things that exist today, CSS media queries that allow you to create an individual site that has customizations for all the different possible screens where your data could be consumed. And just in case my last screen didn't drive the point home, let's not do this. Can we? Let's agree. I'm not going to do this. Okay. So that being said, there is another route to go. We have app stores. And on a mobile device, app store probably makes a decent amount of sense. If you're trying to create a very specific experience for a specific platform, if you need some level of deep hardware integration, that being said, the newer APIs inside of HTML5 provide the vast majority of functionality that you're gonna find on a lot of the native SDKs. I mean, things like geolocation, saving local information, everything that you're gonna commonly do, you can do in HTML5. So Adobe made an acquisition last fall of PhoneGap. And we've since taken PhoneGap and open sourced it now. It's called Cordova. And that takes your HTML5 content and wraps it in a native wrapper, gives you hooks to the OS, so you can leverage your HTML experience and have a native device, publish it through the App Store if it's something you want to sell. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with going native. Just know that there's a route that you can take HTML and not have to relearn multiple SDKs, deployment processes. So HTML PhoneGap, it's pretty awesome. So then there's this guy. I think many of us have heard of Mr. Zeldman here. And I think what he says here is central to responsive web design. That content precedes design. Design in the absence of content is not design, it's decoration. And if you don't have your content defined when you're creating your design, your responsive design, you're not going to be successful. Trying to push in a bunch of lorem ipsum text, you're not going to know how much text you're actually going to have. Therefore, when the screen scales, how is it going to break down? You need to have that sense of realism of how that content's going to adapt, but then you also need to know what of that content is more important to my user on this device, or at this time. So get your content down first. And so I do believe responsive design is much more of a philosophy than a technique. This philosophy applies to designers as well as developers, and as well to your IAs, your UX. I think the water's getting a little muddied between the different groups. But it's something that everybody, that the whole team has to adopt. Not only by defining your content first and then ultimately how it's going to be developed, but how you can approach that as a team. So a little philosophy chunk here. So Aikido, I think, is kind of an interesting martial art where it's not about being aggressive and going out and having, you know, attack moves. It's about knowing your center and how people are going to try and approach you. So have a firm center and a soft and adaptive periphery. This will allow you to accommodate anything that may come towards you. And really, it is about letting go a certain level of control, because the more you fight that control, the worse off you're going to be. And a good example of that, I think we've heard of the New York Times before. So they've now pushed onto the web, but they were They were founded in 1851, so they've done this newspaper thing for a little while now. And there's also another news publication out there called the Boston Globe. And I'm assuming if you guys are here, you've heard of responsive design, and therefore you've heard of the Boston Globe. But they were founded in 1872 and have taken a drastically different tack to how they approach the web. So here's the New York Times, and when you start to play with this site, that's not good. This is representing how I'm going across all the different screens where this site could be consumed. I don't even think there's a whole lot to say to that. Like, that is just not good. And I'm sorry if there's New York Times people here. I'm going to revisit this a couple times. So let's take a look at the Boston Globe. So, I mean, first off, you can see my content is filling from edge to edge. And as I start scaling it, the content itself starts to shift. Content's dropping out, other content's being promoted. And again, it's carrying that core philosophy of giving me what's important on the screen size that I'm currently looking at. Now, when I start to even go bigger than what it was originally, the screen also adapts to these large screens. It's putting out more information. It's even giving me more advertisements. Like, there's things that you can leverage on a much bigger screen that you can't leverage on a small screen. You know, there's both business and consumer implications to having a small and a large screen strategy. So what was the big difference between these two different publications? And I think it's relatively easily summed up. This guy. Ethan, phenomenal guy. You know, he worked with the Filament Group to really transform the way the Boston Globe is perceived on the web. It was, I think, a great example that all of us are going to be able to go back next week and go to our boss, sit down, and say, you know what, here's actually a working way of a content-heavy site. You know, it takes all of those edge cases, and it has an answer for them. All in all, it's really impressive. I struggled tremendously in putting this presentation together to not keep coming back to the Boston Globe as just a great example, but it is. I mean, spend some time with it. Look at it on all your different devices. Watch it expand and contract. Look at the content that drops out, and think about the whys. And again, apply just this general philosophy to it. And it's the question and answers inside that I think the more time you spend with it, the more it's going to mean. So Ethan created this blog post for A List Apart. And this was back in May of 2010. You know, it was really just as the Boston Globe project was getting rolling and getting a firm understanding of why this is important. And this individual blog post changed everything. And it's amazing to see such a huge movement. I mean, yeah, we are standing room only in here, and we can trace it all back to this. That just doesn't happen all that often. So he followed that up with this book called Responsive Web Design. If you guys have not read it, read it now. It's like 75 pages. I think it's like $10. Spend an afternoon. You'll read it in just a couple hours. And it again, I think it speaks a lot to the philosophy. I mean, there is some tactics there. It talks about how you can load your images, some of the problems you're going to encounter. But again, it's the philosophy, it's the mindset, I think, as designers that we have to start to change. You know, back when I was developing and consulting, I inevitably on every single project would have some sort of a come to Jesus moment with the design team because they created these designs that were just beautiful. But once I started doing this on the site, you know, they had no answer. You know, they would design it for 960, but you know, the screen was 1440. Oh, we have to put stuff behind it. You know, it's all of these things that I think as designers now, it's our obligation to move forward and think about how things can be dynamic. And on the development side, I think developers constantly push themselves forward, looking at new languages, new techniques. And I think designers approach it much more from a sense of honing their craft, getting much better at working inside of Photoshop or creating this right effect. And I think we're at an age where you have to broaden yourself as a designer. Get an understanding of HTML, get an understanding of CSS, because ultimately that's the medium where your design's going to be consumed. And if you want the bastardization of your design in the hands of somebody that may or may not care about design, good luck. But otherwise, you know, CSS, it's actually pretty easy. But Ethan and the Filament Group did not create the Boston Globe alone. They actually worked with a design agency based in Boston called Upstatement. And they put out a blog post a couple months ago that talked about how they actually designed a responsive site. I would really encourage you to check it out. There's the link. And interestingly enough, they used InDesign a lot. We've got InDesign, the digital publishing suite that helps you push content to tablet devices. And it basically lets you design in two different orientations at once. And they found that useful. But it was a content-heavy site. It wasn't super graphical or lots of photographs. So it worked out well for them. If you read through, it's a relatively long and in-depth article. Again, it was their approach, and it was an interesting one. So Ethan outlined three things in his book as the main pillars of responsive design. You need to have a foundation of a flexible or fluid grid that you lay everything else out on. You then need to have flexible images and content. And then you make smaller customizations through media queries. So if we look at our Boston Globe example here, this would be pretty daunting. I mean, this site is huge. It leverages all of those things and to an incredible degree. And that's where I say, take your time and start to play with it and dissect the little pieces, because that's how you start to create a responsive site. There's all these little pieces that you have to put together to ultimately create a good piece of consumable content. So let's talk about our flexible grid. So there's three different kinds of primary grids. One being fixed and therefore not flexible, but also valid in some ways. The fluid grid, and then the golden grid. So here's a website, Pelican Fly. They've got some beautiful imagery, lots of text, and it leverages a fixed grid. So a fixed grid, if any of you aren't familiar, there's a 960 grid system out there, I think 960.gs. And right up at the top, they've got a link to their GitHub account where you can download a plugin for Photoshop, Fireworks, Illustrator, OmniGraffle, everybody. And by using that plugin, so if I create a new Fireworks document and I say this is going to be 960 wide, and then go to the commands menu, and there's a 960 grid option. And I choose if I want a 12-column grid, if I want a 16-column grid, and it just shoots all of the guide layers out there for me. So now I have a fixed grid system. So if I look at how this actually works, so now here's the site with the grid system applied. You can see all the columns line up perfectly. It provides the order that you really require when you put this content together. And again, I'll show an example later on today that is a little more cluttered, and taking this route is a bit more preferred. I thank you as your consumer. But if we watch it in action, as the screen starts to scale, when the content hits the edge, it does line up again, but it snaps. And so there we're hitting a media query. We're also changing the content. We went from 3 columns to 2 columns. Here's a column of content and images, and down to a single mobile. Again, always lining up with that grid. Things are absolutely positioned here. I mean, there is a solution for your mobile devices. There is a solution for your tablet in both landscape and portrait, and then also your desktop. And I think taking this route gives you the most control. If you really want to define where every pixel is going to be in each of these breakpoints, this is a viable option. Then we move to the fluid grid. And this is going to be much more flexible and I think adapting to the needs of your customers much easier. And we get to a fluid grid by starting at a fixed grid and applying this equation. This will be the math portion of today's presentation. So let's look at the equation here a little bit more, where I have target, context, and result. So this is going to be my target. I take one of these individual columns, I measure it out. So if I do a 960 wide app and it's 60 pixels, so this guy is going to represent 60 pixels. Then I look at my context, and so now that's everything all the way across. I divide the two, and that gives me a percentage for just that single column. Now, you never create content that's just a single column wide. You usually group multiple columns together. So let's look at it in practice. So if I take a 1024 screen, this is what I'm going to target. If I'm targeting 1024, that really means I'm designing for 960. These numbers probably sound familiar. So I have 12 60-pixel columns. I'm going to take those in a relatively common layout. I'm going to have a bar on the left, a bar on the right, and a center column for content. You can see the numbers there. Now, if I take that and integrate them into my equation, we now have a nice percentage. I can now apply that percentage to the rules that I attach to each of those containers. So this is a site, actually, that you would find on a list apart. I believe Ethan actually put this one together. And it was, again, just such a fantastic example of a fluid layout. So I have my content on the left here, and then my content on the right. So on the left, we're looking at 388 pixels. On the right, 804. I do my math, and I get these numbers. So now, in my relatively simple markup, where I'm defining the styles that are attached to these two containers, everything will now move nicely. Okay, so this is the actual site in motion. And you can see the images scale, the text wraps. This guy appears to be moving smaller than the right, but since the percentages is different, but it actually works out. This is the picture of a fluid site. It gives you everything that you need. And I think some of the debate to having a purely fluid site is it as consumable? Are there ways that I should leverage other kinds of layout as I get to different smaller screens? So therefore, I think we're ultimately, you should use a mixture of some of these different layouts. And you know, I'm actually going to jump out because I want to show you this. So I'm just sitting here in Chrome, and I've got the DevTools popped up. If you guys have not leveraged the DevTools before, they are awesome. My header's over there, so you wouldn't see it. I think it's Vue Developer Tools, something like that. And you get this little pop-up on the bottom. And so as I start to roll over some of these different areas, I can actually see how some of these different areas are laid out. And so if you find yourself as a designer who may not have a tremendous technical background and you want to understand how a lot of these sites start to lay out, this is going to be your fastest and easiest route. You know, so I'm hovering over, I see this is the area that he's talking about, and right here I see how it's actually structured. So it has a media query, and it's looking for different screens. So these are also the selectors, but I'm defining a width of just under 66%. And I say just under 66% because I don't want to read it, but again, that doesn't mean you shouldn't just write it in as 66%. The math equations typically generate relatively long numbers, but the numbers are right. So put right numbers in your code, don't round. Again, if I roll over here, you can see here it's defined the numbers as well. So you can see how things are going to change based on the percentage. Okay, back we go. Hopefully. All right, our last grid system, the Golden Grid. Golden Grid is just awesome. If you guys are familiar with just this general rule of the world and nature and existence, you find it everywhere. You know, in nature, you find it in shells, you find it in sunflowers, storms even form it. It's kind of one of those magic numbers where I think if we understood this number, we could probably solve everything else. But it's been used forever. Architecture, painting. It's something that we as humans are naturally drawn to. When we see it, we, even if it's not apparent, we look at what's created by it and recognize it as beauty. So naturally, we should design our websites with it, right? So here's an example. Anderson Weiss, they have a fantastic website. It's full of amazing imagery. And this, I'm assuming they worked on the W. Austin, just a couple blocks away from here. Super cool bars inside it, if you should try and make it over there. But if you look at how this site resizes, it's unlike the previous ones, where they stick to this rule of thirds. There we go. So the content on the right is slimming down just slightly, but then when the left-hand content got too small, it snapped to the bottom. But then what they also do, interestingly, is when you do some vertical resizing, it'll push them back because it needs to maintain kind of that visual appeal and that rule of thirds between all of your content. I think they're relatively unique in the way that they've handled their layout, and I would strongly encourage you guys to sit there and again, play with this site. Resize it, look at where it breaks, play with it on different devices, and get a feel for why this is a pretty interesting approach. So the other thing that you're going to have to do is think about layout as an enhancement. So there's the philosophy of progressive enhancement, and something I definitely want to reiterate if you weren't here this morning. One of our evangelists, Greg Ruiz, posed the question to the audience, do all websites and web experiences need to be the same on every single browser? No, they don't. Not at all. Not even on an IE6 versus an IE10 versus a Chrome. I think as humans, we try to help everybody along and say, no, don't be on IE6, upgrade, it's okay, the water's fine. But you know, at the end of the day, you gotta cut your losses. Some people, they just can't be helped. And that shouldn't penalize me, who's running Chrome and just updates every day with the latest and greatest stuff. So, you know, create an experience targeting the people that you want to target. If you're targeting somebody who's running IE6, odds are they're not going to put their credit card into a website, or, you know, they're not going to go to the website to find out where your business is. You know, like, let's just not worry about them anymore. So, that being said, if I'm going to follow this enhancement, I'm going to leverage media queries. So we've got a ton of media queries over here to the left, and they're super small in hopes that you don't read them. Most of them work, some of them don't work, the majority are irrelevant. The ones that you really need to worry about is width. I care about width. And if you're targeting a mobile device, I certainly care about orientation. And then also with the rise of these new high-res displays, there's a special WebKit prefixed media query called device pixel ratio. And this is essentially the iPhone 4 versus the iPhone 3S is how it understands the way things should be laid out. It simply has a tag that doubles your pixels. This works great for some text and for containers. It works terribly for images. So that's something to keep in mind. So this is typically how it's going to look. I have my different media queries. I want to define a min width. I can pre-pin min and max. And now inside of those curly braces, I can give specific information that I want to be applied to the page or that specific style at that specific size. And again, that being said, know your audience. When you're creating content, think long and hard about who's going to be consuming this and where. If I'm creating a page that a bunch of kids are going to be consuming on an iPad, I'm going to define in my CSS first those most common attributes. Then Apple, you know, they went and did this the other day. It's going to be, I ordered one. It's going to be cool, but man, it's going to be a pain. 2548, 1436, packed into 9.7 images or inches, giving you 265 DPI. That's incredible. Some of the problems you're going to have here is to get an image to look great on that screen, it's going to be big. And big images come with big file size. But thank God they wrapped in LTE and are charging me a boatload, so I'll be able to download those images and pay them a bunch of money every month. But let's break free from the pixels. There's a great quote, and I'm not going to try his name. It says that we as a community can change the way we approach design. We can remove half of the images from the web just by leveraging new technologies in HTML5, CSS3, and SVG. Like, take this one to heart. I think we as a design community have the power to change this. This needs to be thought about up front. When you're concepting your design, as you're creating the first few iterations of your design, you know, you can still do things like tiling a background, but when you create a header, think to yourself, is this something that could actually be drawn in CSS, or do I need to have a 2,000 wide pixel bitmap header? You know, like, let's not do that. Leverage CSS and all of its new power. So some best practices, and man, I hate that as a title, because especially in the web, there's so many different ways to do everything, and so many different use cases that I'm not even going to try and push this on you. It's a bit more philosophical. So as you're loading in graphics into your CSS, start with your low-res images first. If you are on a high bandwidth large screen device, then that's fine. We don't care that we happen to load in an extra small bitmap. But if you are on a small screen device, then good. You're there, you're faster, you've downloaded less. But then do everything in your power to be resolution independent. Let's just all look at that for a moment, because that is the key takeaway from today. Be resolution independent. leverage CSS for that. Leverage SVG. If you are an Illustrator user, Illustrator actually saves out SVG quite well. You can create your icons and export them as SVG, and they're going to scale beautifully on any device. And then using the app font face, now your text will scale perfectly. You won't see any jaggies. It'll be the size that you need. And again, that's really going to help you with your text. To dig into a little bit more about this, a great blog post that came out the other day from Menacing Cloud, Edward Kant. Check it out. He's got a ton of other great content on his website. And just spend some time there and see what kinds of things resonate for you. So hierarchy. Hierarchy is so important as you're creating this content. It not only helps to convey importance, but then on a technical level, your hierarchy inside of your DOM defines how your page is going to adapt as it gets smaller. It's important. So, I'm sorry, we're back here. Do we have anybody from New York Times here? So hierarchy, if you start to look at all the different things that are going on in this page, we have so many sizes. We have over 11 different font sizes, styles. This is just hugely difficult for you as a consumer of this information to look at and figure out what's important. The titles are barely larger than the body text, and in some of the categories, the titles are the same size as the body text. It's just super difficult to read. So don't die by the grid. All of these rules at some point in time are meant to be broken. I think any industry that you're working in. You have to know the rules first and then venture out and break them. But make sure you understand the rules that you're breaking before you break them, or else people will make fun of you. Nobody likes that. And so as you're laying out this information that you've already defined, it starts to logically group together in modules. So these modules, you can see that a piece of content needs to stay relevant to each other as your screen sizes change. So again, here we're back at the Boston Globe, and I've highlighted some of these modules of information. We have some breaking news up there at the top. It's at the top of the page because it's the most important thing right now. It's breaking. Then we have our main title and the whole body of content that goes with that title. But then here I've got a huge screen, so I've got another piece of content that's sitting next to it. Now, as I start to condense this down to potentially a tablet view, I've started to drop out some things, and I'm really thinking about my hierarchy. I'm asking what's important. So, obviously, my breaking news is important. It's up at the top. Again, my primary title, it's important. It comes next, and then the content directly related to that piece. So you can see the hierarchy here. Now we look at DOM order, and we're back here at C Sparkbox, and I want to point you to the header up there. So now I've got two containers basically sitting inside of a div floating in the center of the page, and the guy on the right, he's floated right, the guy on the left, he's floated left, and the order in which they're defined inside of my DOM means that as it collapses, these two things just slide right on top of each other. So again, from a technical standpoint, think about the way that you're structuring your DOM. So there's also an interaction portion to hierarchy. This is the desktop screen for Illy. Some tasty coffee. But they put some thought into what I'm going to be doing on the desktop version. They're showing me the flavors. They're showing me all the different varieties that they have. And then all the way down at the bottom, they have a couple of other kind of navigational things I can do. But then when I move to a desktop or to a mobile device, I have totally changed the focus of this site. All that same content still exists, but I've reordered it on the page. So as you're designing this content, be task-oriented. Ask yourself, what do you hope this person is going to do on this device with this content? I thought it was interesting. On the mobile, the very first button is the Find Me button. Because I'm probably somewhere. I'm not sitting on my couch on my laptop. I'm going to be out, and I need to find out where to get some. Or maybe buy. On the phone, I'm more likely to maybe be impulsive. And then also the sharing options. You've got great integration on your phone to share and be more social. So they've taken the things that you commonly do on your device, pushed them up top, and then again, here you can see the flavors they define, and they've pushed that down because consuming large amounts of data from your phone is not typically what people do because they don't spend long on there. Think about what this person is going to do in 30 seconds or a minute. That's about the amount of time span that you're going to get, and that's probably on the high side. Yes. The where. I thought it was interesting. I saw an article a couple weeks ago that Android users are more likely to be using their phone on the can than iPhone users. I don't know why that would be, though. Moving on. Here's another good example. Stefan Carver, he's very big on putting the typography out there and really putting his message. This is basically a portfolio site. But as it starts to adapt through the different screens, he's still maintaining the hierarchy. He's trying to really push the content that's going to be relevant for you here. So being a portfolio site, on an iPad, I can still put a very good display, a very good message of what I want the person to get. But when I get down to the mobile, I'm scaling back on my navigation and I'm going to text. I'm just pulling back to the core thing that I want them to take away in the short period of time I have with them on this very small device. So images and content. This is kind of the easiest way to deal with it. If you just tell your image to be a max of 100%, as the page scales, your image is going to scale down. This is also the most simplistic way to deal with it. It doesn't solve for all cases, and ultimately, it also has you loading in a very large image and then scaling it down, and that's not very nice to our mobile friends. So there's another project that's been getting going, and essentially this is the project that the filament group put together when creating the Boston Globe. You can go on their site and check it out. It's a bit JavaScript intensive, but if you want to dig in a little bit deeper, they've been doing some really cool stuff. And if we want to look a little bit further ahead, the W3C has actually recognized this as a problem. We all love to start there. And they put together a working group of how we can start to address this at the browser level. And hopefully we'll see some advancements from that sooner than later. But I want to show you something cool that actually we've been working on. There we go. Where's my mouse? So what I have here, there we go, is a CSS-based layout. This is using CSS regions. This is a relatively new addition. I am just running in Chrome. There's no magic up sleeves. We're good. This, you could leverage this today. It's not going to work in some of your older browsers, but you can define the regions where text is going to flow to, and it's going to flow from one container to the next container, and you have the power to define that. You can see as I'm paging through, it's also creating pagination. And as I go, there we go. And I resize, it's just reflowing the text. If you're doing a text-heavy site at all, that is awesome. This is part of our new web platform group. We've put together a group of talented engineers to start working with all of our different browser friends, working with the W3C to get some of these expressive changes built right into the browser. We've made some announcements last fall, and you guys are going to be hearing a lot more over the course of this year. So something else cool that's coming, flexible box model. This does exist in a couple of browsers today. It is kind of changing, but when it gets solidified, this is going to be rad. It allows you to create a box, and then rather than just having the basic up and down that HTML layout has had before, it gives you options. I can create a horizontal box. So when I add new elements to the container, it starts to lay them out horizontally. I can also define a vertical box and have all kinds of different parameters where I can customize these boxes and really have the container starting to logically control the layout of its contents. This is actually another really cool project going on, object-oriented CSS. I check out the GitHub page, the project page here, and you know this is a little bit more technical, but it's ways of creating logical, usable chunks of content where I can have styles, apply styles, and easily reuse that. If you want to start to manage a much larger site, object-oriented CSS is a pretty interesting way to go. Okay, so action items. The next 15 minutes. If you haven't done this before, check out these frameworks. HTML5 boilerplate, download it, install it, learn it, love it. It's going to help you create content that's more reliable and faster than you have before. Skeleton Grid, again, it's a super easy grid system to pull down and integrate into your workflow. If you guys don't get these written down, I'll post the slides, don't worry. And then Twitter Bootstrap. Phenomenal. Twitter Bootstrap is as cool as it comes. It has tons of UI components. It's now responsive. It gives you a UI for how you can customize all the different CSS variables and spit out a theme that's going to work for you. Some good reading stuff. Obviously, if you haven't read the book, just you can go online if the internet is working. Just get it. Smash Magazine is a great publication. They've got some great articles on responsive design. This is just one of them, but check it out. A List Apart, again, they really focus on the way the modern web should be built. If you don't spend time routinely on their site, do it. And the last one, again, it just has a lot of super relevant content to creating a responsive site. So here's my pitch. So anybody in the audience happen to be a badass JavaScript developer? Interested in responsive design? Lives in San Francisco? Maybe wants to live in San Francisco? I think you know where I'm going here, guys. I'll be around here afterwards and over in our lounge. Love to talk to you.